session number 25206, Reel 2.
Graham Allen, Reel 2. So you were just describing the guns on the Prince of Wales.
Yes, well, I, speaking with a certain amount of hindsight now, you will know that up to that time, the major guns in British battleships were 15-inch twin turrets. And these were a tried and tested design. But for various reasons, the King George V class were equipped with 14-inch guns because it was thought their rate of fire would be slightly faster and they could throw a pretty large tonnage of shells, and therefore it was worth going on to 14-inch. But of course, this was a major... gun turrets are extremely complicated, and they require an awful lot of adjusting and checking and modifying to make them work smoothly, because you have this enormous great barbette which goes right down at the bottom of the ship, complicated machine, all rotating, all going round in circles. It's very, very difficult.
Was this her maiden voyage that you were going to set off on? Or?
No, it wasn't her maiden voyage. She had been at sea. She'd done testing, but she was commissioning, really, and working up. Right. And working up, normally, in the Navy, would have taken 2 or 3 years, that you couldn't be confident that the ship was 100% effective before you tested everything to a great extent. Well, the Prince of Wales, unfortunately, did not have that benefit. We worked up as much as we could. The ship's company had to settle down. The officers had to learn their jobs properly. And altogether, it was a very, very difficult time with lots of things going wrong. Being an executive in the seamanship side, I didn't know the half of it. But obviously, had I been on the engineering side, which I would not have been as a midshipman, but had I been an engineering officer, they must have had a terrible time because there was always something adrift. Well, we moved up to Scarpa Flow, and early spring of 1941, and did more exercising there until, of course, the fateful day when the Bismarck and the Prince Eugen set out to go round Iceland and to enter the Atlantic. And Prince of Wales and the Hood were sent off to intercept.
What did you know about the Bismarck? I mean, what was...
Well, very little. I mean, I knew very little. We just knew it was one of the big German ships, and it was a real problem, and it had to be stopped, and that's all I knew about it. Mm. I mean, its capacity and its the details of it, nothing at all.
Did you fear it? I mean, was this...
Well, I mean, apprehension, a certain amount of apprehension, yes, but not really, I would say at that stage, not fear, because we hadn't had the experience to be... afraid of anything, really, I suppose. One was completely ignorant. However, that soon changed. We met up with the Bismarck. We knew where the Bismarck was because they were being shadowed, as people know, by the Norfolk and Suffolk, the two cruisers, who had very long range. And they were keeping them in their radar. And we were on an intercepting course. And on the morning of May the 24th, 1940, which was my 18th birthday, we were approaching the Bismarck and ready for action. And I thought to myself, I wonder if I'll see my 19th birthday. Well, as you know, we opened fire, I should go back a bit here. My action station was quite an interesting one. I was in what was called then the upper plot. Now, the system was that on the bridge, there was a way of looking down through the floor of the bridge into the room below, into the upper plot, which was below. And it was called the upper plot because there was a plotting machine there. It was the size of about yard by 3 foot by 2 foot, and it was a glass sheet. And under it was a lot of mechanism and a moving light. So this device, when set up, would move this light according to the movement of the ship. So you had a repeater in the upper part of the ship, speed and course. And the little, it was all just a lot of cogwheels and axles and things. And this thing slowly moved across the screen, and to which you set the scale. This is all quite, mechanical, but quite straightforward. And every half minute, it was the duty of somebody there to put little pencil markers to join up the dots. And so, from above, the captain could look through a sort of pedestal in which were a couple of eyepieces, which were focused on the. And he could see the picture of where the ship was, of course, because at the same time we were also plotting the positions of the enemy in different colours, you see. So you'd see the way the battle was developing, and you'd see these squiggly lines, and he could see exactly where the enemy was, etc.
And you were actually plotting.
Now, my job as midshipman was in that plot, and the other traditional occupant of the upper plot was the schoolmaster lieutenant. So there was a schoolie and I operating all this. My other job there was to keep the log and the navigator up on the bridge. Normally the log is kept on the bridge by the midshipman of the watch, but in action it was, there wasn't much, they wanted to keep people clear of the bridge. So the navigator would call down exactly what he wanted logged. So I remember, you see, that it was something like 6:05 hood hit. No, 6 o'clock hood hit, 6 o'clock hood on fire, 6 o'clock hood blown up, and 6 o'clock hood hit. Something like 2 minutes later, hood on fire. 2 minutes after that, about 6:04, hood blown up, and 6:06 hood sunk. And that was only 200 yards away, you know.
That must have been quite chilling.
Oh, chilling, I should say it was, because immediately after that, the German gunnery was, as always, excellent. Immediately after that, the Prince Eugen and the Bismarck turned their guns onto the Prince of Wales, and a shell went right through the bridge, killing two midshipmen, one or two signalmen, blinding Lieutenant Esmond, who was Esmond Knight. Remember Esmond Knight, who was an actor? He was blinded there, or almost blinded, and severely wounding the captain. The captain, quite rightly, now at that moment, all the guns of the ship, the 14-inch guns, which had been giving trouble, and gradually had been put out of action because of mechanical faults, because the ships were running. There was one gun still working. The captain very wisely opened the range and it turned away and saved the ship. Because had we not done so, we would have been we would have been blasted and certainly sunk. So he saved the day, and I'll come back to that later.
That hit on the bridge had on you down in the upper plot. What did you see? What did you hear?
Oh, well, that was quite serious, because we knew that there was something serious. All the lights went out. There were emergency lights hanging from the deckhead, which looked rather like miners' lanterns. They had a plug into the power supply, and they were run by a battery, and they were supposed to be fully charged, so that when the power went off, you see, these lights would come on. So his ship was hit, shaking, lights went out, emergency lights came on. Great. They lasted about 10 seconds. I thought, who bought these? Who maintained that lot? Eventually the lights came on, but the shell must have gone right through the top of this inspector, inspection pedestal. Blood started dripping through the ceiling onto the plot, which we saved, which we put on something to stop it. So we used a cocoa tin, because, at sea, one has hot cocoa on the bridge. so this had, we'd been up since, of course, you know, midnight and before, and we'd had some a can of cocoa, cold, and that cold cocoa and blood didn't look very nice. I can tell you, the log which I was keeping was spattered with blood, and so was the chart. You know.
Did you have any idea at that time, you know, what the casualties had been?
No, I didn't.
In command,
no, we didn't. No, we didn't. We knew they were up on the bridge, and we knew we'd changed course because we had a repeater down there, and we saw the range was increasing, and we were, as the range went increased, our spirits rose. I might say we realised it'd be a disaster so far. What did cheer me up was that, greatly daring, because I, you know, one might be familiar with one's seniors, I said to the instructor lieutenant, when we opened the range and the battle had stopped for it, I said, I didn't enjoy that very much, sir. And he said, no, neither did I. And I felt greatly cheered at that fellow spirit. I thought, you got the right idea. So at least we were still alive, but I say about 13 or 14 people were killed. It was at this, so you know, there's plenty of accounts of the Bismarck action, the Prince of Wales and the Hood, but as far as a personal concerned, we soon had to break off altogether and go and refuel, because another of the weaknesses of the King George V class was that their fuel consumption was much too great. Their miles per gallon was much too low. And in fact, they did about half the range they should have done. And this was a major design fault which had a very serious effect on the conduct of the war. Because later on, when the Home Fleet got to the Bismarck and eventually did sink it, I mean, it was touch and go whether the King George V was going to have enough fuel to get back to port. And Churchill was even talking, you know, tow her back. Anyway, so that was a major design fault of the whole class. And, of course, subsequent events showed other faults. So the ship was running out of fuel, and we had to turn back to Iceland. We went to a place called Valfjord, which was a beautiful place. And to a tanker there and refueled. On the way there, of course, we had the funeral of those who'd been killed. And again, a sobering experience, you know, to see all these bodies lined up, stitched up in canvas, except one, which was Midshipman Dreyer. Nice lad. And I think the shell must have gone right through him, because he wasn't a body, he was just a parcel. There was this parcel of canvas, and you thought, oh God.
And that was conducted on your way to...
On the way to Iceland, and they were, they were sewn up in the traditional ways, weight of the feet, you know, sewn up in canvas, stitched up, and put on a sort of, and there was sort of a little shelf rigged on the side of the quarter deck, and they just tipped them up and down they went. When we got to Iceland, Valfjord, H-V-A-L, Valfjord, this was, say, May the 25th or 26th, springtime in Iceland. I mean, I knew nothing about Iceland, but we were going to be there for about 3 or 4 hours. So the commander or whoever said, oh, the mids can have a run ashore, they like, you see. So we took a boat and we had a couple of hours just walking around on the hills. Sorry to be a bit emotional.
Yeah. It's obviously, I mean, it must have been a terrific experience. I mean, you were all had to keep going and the
yeah, that's right.
Had
yes.
to continue and...
Yes, well, it was there in Iceland, of course, there. You see, you realised, I mean, it sort of struck home, A, how beautiful Iceland was in this with the spring flowers. I'd never given them a thought, you know, spring flowers not be my schoolboy, you know,
yeah. Care.
But how beautiful it was, and of course, and secondly, you know, how lucky we were to be alive.
Yes, and back on ground.
And back on ground.
Safety, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So after Iceland, was back to Rosyth for repairs, because we had taken several hits, you see. And in fact, it wasn't until we got back to Rosyth into the dry dock, and they were pumping the water out of the dock, and gradually the bottom of the ship was being exposed, that it was seen there was a hole down below, which nobody had known anything about, somewhere under the, and it was under one of, I think, the starboard quarter magazine. And there was a shell in there which hadn't gone off. I mean, you know, a remarkable bit of luck that had things been otherwise, the whole of the rear of the ship would have been blown off.
So the whole crew, whole complement, had had a sort of near-death experience.
Yes, that's right.
That takes a little while to come to terms with.
It does, and, you know, everybody knew it had been a close thing, and we hadn't done too well, and the hood was gone, the mighty hood. And, in fact, not only were the ship's company aboard for the battle, but there were also a lot of Vickers Armstrong fitters who were still on board during the battle, and they tried to make the Richard turrets work.
Really?
You know, it was, I didn't know these, but they were fitters, etc., but they were there during the battle, and they were still trying to make the turrets work properly, I mean, a year later.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we were back in Rosyth, we were given some survivors' leave, and not survivors' leave, but we were given leave, and I think just over a week, and the ship was patched up in Rosyth, you see, and then we joined again.
Where did you go on your leave? That must have been.
Well, you see, I say I was born in Jersey. My parents were in Jersey. My father was a Londoner, and his brother lived in London with his wife, my aunts and uncle, and they were also called Alan. So I had put them down as my next of kin, because there was no point putting down next of kin to my parents, who were in Jersey, because they were, you know, you couldn't go to anything to them anyway. So I knew that my uncle would get in touch by Red Cross postcards, and in view of the fact that I later became a prisoner of war, it was just as well, really. Anyway, so we then got back to Rosyth, and we went back to Scarpa.
Imagine must have been so many ships there, such a busy
place. Well, it was a busy place. There were sometimes a lot of ships, sometimes not so many. It was nothing much to do except you could go ashore. There was a canteen there, which where a lot of sailors got drunk as they could. There was some sort of entertainment there. You could go to Kirkwall and walk around the town, but there wasn't much to see in Kirkwall. And we could go sailing. There were onto dinghies on board, and you could sail in the flow. Sometimes, of course, the weather was pretty rough. One of the jobs of midshipmen on a battleship was running the boats. Now, the boats were various sizes, and there were two high-speed motorboats, which was the officers' motorboats, and these were 35-foot motor launches with twin screws, and they zoomed along very satisfactorily, and the coxswain, or that is the midshipman in charge, had a leading seaman and about three or four seamen to act as crew, and you could sit at the helm of this thing and have a wheel, and really it was great fun. You see, there were also a couple of smaller boats, and there was a launch. Now the launch was a big open boat with a diesel engine and what was called a kitchen rudder. Now, a kitchen rudder is quite interesting. One propeller, and around the outside, you didn't have a rudder behind the propeller. You had the rudder in the form of two slices of, you might say, two slices of melon rind on either side of it, pivoted at the bottom. So this could direct the flow directly to one side or the other, or even close up altogether and direct it forward so you could go astern, and very, very maneuverable. Well, the job of if your job was running the launch, then you'd find yourself taking seamen ashore on the Liberty boat, and collecting them in the evening. Sometimes this was a bit tricky because you'd have a lot of unruly drunken sailors and you'd have to try to assert yourself and say, you're not coming on board until you're sewn up, you see, and I'll have you all on a charge and that sort of thing. So the great thing was to get back to the ship, hang off 200 or 300 yards away from the ship until everybody was quiet, and then get them on board, you see, and then the officer of the watch would inspect them. And but that was just part of the normal running of ship, which was at anchor.
How did you find, you know, conducting the discipline, you know, and getting the respect of the sort of...
Well, you see, because a lot of Natlos would really regard midshipmen with some degree of contempt. They knew they weren't proper officers and they didn't know much and that sort of thing, you see. However, you know, one just had to, A, show that you did know what you were doing and that you weren't going to stand any nonsense and that you weren't a toffee-nosed twerp, you see. And there were some, you know, generally one got on all right. But I think it was important not to give yourself airs, that, you know, to pretend you were more than you were, you see. But people knew that, you know, behind you was the Lords of the Admiralty in the end. So the other thing about being at Recife, I remember, we were at, it was just above, you're just above the fourth bridge. Now, if I remember right, on the right bank of the fourth is Queen's Ferry. And we often use, and if people went on, had an evening's leave to Edinburgh, they would go by ship's launch to Queen's Ferry and then get on the train and go into Edinburgh. This was all right during the day, but in the night, of course, it was a blackout. And very tricky to, surprising now, you see, you have an 18-year-old boy in charge of a launch with a lot of officers on board, and you'd be trying to find your way through the pitch blackness of the River Forth to Queensbury Jetty, which was a slipway, and on the side of the slipway were a lot of piles which gradually disappeared into the water, so it was quite possible, if you didn't watch it, that you'd suddenly find a pile coming up through the bottom of the boat, you see. And in fact, this did happen to one of my friends. He got his leave stopped for a fortnight. but so it was quite tricky finding a way around the fourth in the dark, you know. And but it had to be done, and people, you know, survived. In the Scarpa Flow, I remember I was in charge of the launch, which was and the waves, even in the flow, were about 10 feet high. They were enormous, and the ship was at a buoy. No boats could be out except the launch, which was at the very stern of the battleship on a short boom, just bobbing away there. And the problem, if that was called away for some purpose, the problem was to get from the battleship into the launch, you see, because the launch was going up and down, and you had to scramble down a ladder. And I remember at the time thinking, if my mum could see me now, she'd be very alarmed, because it really was easy enough to drop off and fall into the water, and, you know, a real problem. However, that was, you know, part of the fun of being there. We and all the midshipmen really enjoyed it. It was really quite nice. What else can I? Now, what are the details?
Were you there for long?
No, not long. Mm-hmm. In September, there was a hush-hush project, which was to get a convoy to Malta. And they were going to send a heavily guarded convoy to Malta, and they had various ships, and they also had, I think, one of these very fast mine layers, which could do about 45 knots. And there was the Manxman, and the Manxman was the only one I can remember, but they were given names of islands. So we proceeded from Scarpa down to the Mediterranean, and we had to go through the Straits of Gibraltar at dead of night, all blacked out, so that none of the many spies on either side of the would see us. But I mean, when you consider that all the whole of Algeciras and Gibraltar was a blaze of light, and so was Tangiers. He didn't have to be a very good spy to be sitting on the beach and you'd see this great black bulk going past. You know, you'd realise that something was up.
Did you have any idea?
Not really, no.
Did you know where you were going?
No, we didn't. Not then. After we'd been going, we knew then, we were told. But it was all... we weren't told that sort of thing too frequently, you see. Anyway, the convoy was... we met with the convoy, and we started off towards Malta. And we were attacked by the Italian Navy. Well, this, I think, was quite significant. You see, the Italian Navy and Air Force mounted quite a big attack, but we had a large force. We had, I think, aircraft carrier there as well. And, in fact, they were beaten off quite satisfactorily. And then, after, all according to plan, we turned back. The convoy carried on. The Manxmen shot off into as fast as they could, trying to get to Malta under cover of darkness. And I think it was a moderately successful operation. But our job was done. We, you know, and we came back. We hadn't suffered any casualties. The anti-aircraft guns had been, those were twin 525 turrets. They'd been quite effective. And altogether, you know, it was regarded as a moderately successful operation. Certainly, it was, I think, in Whitehall, because the impression which was then given to the chief of the naval, the deputy chief of the naval staff, who was Admiral Tom Phillips of ill fame, was that a well-organized battleship's guns could keep any number of torpedo bombers at bay, right? Of course, what he didn't take into account was that, A, the Italian torpedo bombers were not all that good. They were driven by Italians whose heart was not 100% in the war. And they were not Japanese, who had, A, the best torpedo bombers in the world, C, the best torpedoes in the world, I think, aerial torpedoes, and they were driven by pilots who were really prepared to give everything, as the Italians were not, and I don't blame the Italians for that. But certainly, I think a lot of wrong conclusions were drawn from that particular episode. That you know, that battleships were far less vulnerable than they actually were.
What did you think about Phillips at the time?
Oh, I never heard of him. No. Though, of course, you see, I should have. At least other people had, because after the Bismarck action, I tell you, we had one gun still working. The bridge had been hit. We were due to be hit by a great many more salvos, and the captain turned away. Admiral Phillips, who was a gunnery officer, he brought up in the gunnery tradition, you see, gunnery specialist, he thought that, and he set in train, he wanted Captain Leach, of the Prince of Wales, he wants him court-martialed for turning away from the enemy. I mean, he is really, I think, thought that, you know, Nelson's dictum always applied, engage the enemy more closely, whether it was sensible or not sensible. I mean, looking back now, you know, the folly of the man is, it can't be exaggerated. Because, you know, it's one thing for Nelson to say that when his guns work better the closer you got. But in the modern, in the Navy then, of course, the worst place to be was about 10 miles away when you got plunging fire, which went straight through. You know, and it Leach saved the ship. And in fact, there was a lot of, I think, ill feeling in the Navy about it, because it was Admiral Tuthy, I think, or the chief of the Admiral in charge of the Home Fleet, who said that if Leach had been court-martialed, he, Admiral Tuthy, would be the prisoner's friend and would defend him. So, of course, with that sort of support, you see, the whole thing fell down. However, it didn't make for very good relations between Captain Leach and Admiral Phillips, you see, who, of course, was Churchill's blue-eyed boy. very short man, Admiral Tom Thumb, he was called, behind his back.
I'll stop you just there. Graham Allen, end of reel 2.